Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Law. I'm Itamar Mann, fellow at Georgetown Law Center, and your host today. It is a great pleasure for me to be talking with Patrick Vail about his new book, The Sovereign Citizen, Denaturalization and the Origins of the American Republic, published by Penn Press this year. Patrick Vail is a visiting professor of law at Yale Law School and a senior research fellow at the French National Research Center in the University of Paris I, Panthéon Sorbonne.
Thank you very much for your very kind invitation and kind introduction.
It's a very big pleasure for me to have you here. And just as a way of beginning, I wanted to hear what brought you to this book in terms of the trajectory of your research. How did you come to study the history of denaturalization in the United States?
So I would say it's a random process, because 3 years ago, I had not the idea, I didn't think I would write this book, The Sovereign Citizen, Denaturalization and the Origin of the American Republic. I had started a project on the comparison of denaturalization in France, the US, and the UK towards Nazi Germany and Soviet Union. Why did I do that? It's because 2 years before, while I was writing the full history of French citizenship law since the French Revolution, I discovered that denaturalization has also existed in the United States through a book of somebody which is known by some of the scholars who have studied the history of citizenship in the U.S., John Cable. He's known because he's the author of an act, the Cable Act, that permitted American women not to lose their citizenship when they married a foreigner, and that was an act of 1922. And he has written a book that is totally unknown about the history of denaturalization in the United States in time of war. In addition to that, I also discovered that a famous author, Giorgio Agamben, an Italian philosopher, has put together the dates of, you know, this denaturalization law in France, 1915, in the UK, 1918, in Portugal, in Italy, in Portugal, 1923, in Italy, 1926. And he has argued that the origin of the massive deprivation of citizenship in Nazi Germany and in Soviet Union were democratic. It has started in France, in the UK. And I wanted to double check that. I wanted to go in the archives and to check the US, the British, and the French history of deprivation of citizenship, and to see how they could have influenced the Nazi policy or the fascist policy of Italy or the Soviet policy. And so I went to the British archive and I found something I have already found in the French archive, is that the British decide to create a proceeding for the dual citizen who were British German and who has fought the British army and government during the time of war. And then I went to the American archives, and what I found was, for me, completely ununderstandable. I could not organize my project with putting together the American, the French, and the British. The American case was special. And so I decided to deal with it, and I discovered it was much more important, much more massive, much more implying the issue of the whole history of the United States in the 20th century. So I decided to write a specific book dedicated to this U.S. history.
Okay, precisely on that point, I would like you to read, if you will, a little paragraph from your book, from a letter of a woman that I would like you to talk about a little. The paragraph on this issue is on page 191. Will you share it with the listeners?
Yes, so it's Emma Goldman. Emma Goldman is the first political denaturalization in the United States. It's very interesting because originally, what makes the U.S. denaturalization history very particular, it is that the denaturalization, which is set in the Naturalization Act of 1906, has one main purpose: to fight fraud and illegality in naturalization, which normally occurs at that time in state courts. The huge majority, 90-95% of the naturalization in the beginning of the 20th century are decided by local state courts. And the federal governments want to make sure that these courts are following the rules set by Congress. So it's why they obtain from Congress the right to institute proceeding of denaturalization in case they discover fraud or illegality. But very soon, a few months after passing the act, they use a pretext to target a radical they want to expel from the United States. And this radical is a woman, Emma Goldman. Emma Goldman is denaturalized through the denaturalization of her first husband, from whom she has divorced 20 years before. Her husband was himself a naturalized Russian Jew, and they found that as probably half of the immigrants of that time, he didn't declare his real date of arrival in the U.S. of his real age, and so they denaturalized her former husband, and by derivation, by consequence of this denaturalization, she loses her citizenship in 1909. So immediately, she writes in Mother Earth, a journal in which she was writing often, a pamphlet titled "A Woman Without a Country," and then 24 years later, she writes in 1933 a second version of "A Woman Without a Country," and it is a paragraph of the second version I will now read. Future historians will wonder at the peculiar phenomenon of American war psychology. While Europe experienced its worst reaction as a result of the war, the United States, in keeping with its spirit of get there first, reached its greatest reactionary zenith before entering the war. Without warning, as it were, it forswore all its revolutionary tradition and customs openly and without shame, and introduce the worst practices of the old world.
So this quotation seems to suggest a continuum between the European policies that you saw in the archives regarding France and Britain and regarding Agamben's thesis and the American policies. That is to say that Goldman did think that there is a relationship, but you disagree with this in some way. Am I misunderstanding you? Or?
Yes, I think she doesn't have the chronology right, because first of all, the UK and France were and still are not a federal country. So they didn't have this issue of conflict between state and between constituting state and the federal government. Secondly, the French and the UK didn't react against anarchism or against the rise of socialism through denationalization before the First World War. So it was an American reaction that could not be set on the model of Europe. And I completely, the first deprivation of citizenship in modern times in Europe is an unknown story, because it's 1848 in the Republican France after the abolition of monarchy. There is the second abolition of slavery, and in the decree of abolition of slavery, there is a provision that says slavery is a crime against humanity that has to be punished by a specific penalty. And what is the penalty? Deprivation of citizenship. You don't have any link between that, provision that has been forgotten and even is not very known by anybody, even in France, and what happened in the US. I think the US created from their own story, the fact that it's a country that constitutes itself through immigration, through massive immigration, especially in 1906, 1907, it's the highest numbers. You have more immigrants in 1907 than you have every year now in the US today, legal immigrants. And so it's a reaction towards, reaction of the assassination of President McKinsey, the rise of massive immigration. So it's a very specific American response.
But it was used for political ends at this period.
Yes, but where she's wrong, and I think I demonstrated in my book, is that she was the target in 1907, 1908. But in 1912, I tell an incredible story in the book where the Attorney General of President Taft, George Wickersham.
That is an amazing story. That is really
who has heard that a local federal attorney has instituted a proceeding of denaturalization against a socialist in the state of Washington, and the federal court has decided his denaturalization, or orders his federal attorney to go back to court and to bring him back to his American citizenship. And not only that, Congress unanimously start a proceeding of impeachment against the federal judge that has denaturalized his socialist. That's 1912. So when she speaks about the climate before the First World War, I completely disagree. And the testimony of civil servant of the Immigration Naturalization Service confirm what I say, that the climate changed completely because of the First World War.
Yeah, George Wickersham is one of the most fascinating characters in your book that is filled with fascinating people. And I would like to hear more about him a little bit in terms of his role in this story of the history, the whole narrative that you create in the book of the history of denaturalization. Who was he, and what exactly is his role in this?
Well, he was a lawyer. He was a Republican from the East Coast. He was a attorney general of President Taft. He arrived in office at the beginning of 1909. And his first act is to sign an instruction as to hugely limit, the possibility, the institution of proceeding of denaturalization. What was the problem? The law of 1906 has ordered the executive, the federal executive government, to institute denaturalization proceeding anytime they found a case of illegality or fraud in naturalization. The problem was that after 1906, they discovered that a huge number of naturalized immigrants has not been naturalized following the law. How did it come? For example, a new immigrant go to court with two witnesses. So the judge check the witness's naturalization document. And they discover that the witnesses have lied about the date of arrival, place of birth, the age, etc. Okay, so you have not been legally naturalized. Let's institute proceeding of the naturalization. So numbers were rising. And suddenly they said, we are going to perturbate the whole society. In many states, probably half or two-thirds of the naturalized American were not legally naturalized at that time. So he sent an instruction to all U.S. attorneys that not to institute proceeding to cancel certificate of naturalization unless some substantial results are to be achieved thereby in the way of the betterment of the citizenship of the country. What did he mean? He mean either there is a court which is corrupted, and we have to fight that. So let's go after the people who have been fraudulently naturalized. Let's denaturalize them. Let's publicize against the court, and let's reinstall these people in their citizenship because they are not responsible of what happened. Or, so that's the first. Let's clean the institution. First target, first purpose. The second issue is, let's go after the American naturalized who are not good Americans. They are criminals, or they have a bad moral character, or they are radicals. In that case, it's possible to continue to implement denaturalization proceedings. But Fickersham had a very narrow approach of what is a radical who should be denaturalized, and he didn't think a socialist, even if he was not a socialist, should be denaturalized. The other thing he did, and that was a fascinating story, because after the Act of 1906, 9 months later, there is a new Act, Expatriation Act, that include a provision that overlap with the denaturalization provision of 1906. It's about the naturalized American who go to live abroad. The Act of 1906 says, if you go to live to your country of origin in the 5 years following your naturalization, you lose your American citizenship. And the Act of 1907 says, if you go to live any time after your naturalization in your country of origin, or for some years in any foreign countries, you lose your American citizenship. And Fickersham didn't want to implement this provision. So he said that he didn't read the act the way the State Department read it. He said, I read it as a suspension of the consular protection. So for me, these people who live abroad, if they come back to the US, they are still American. And the State Department retaliated by saying, okay, you think they are American, we think they are not, so we will not give them passport to come back to the US. And the conflict was partially resolved by a compromise in 1926, a long time after Fickersham had left office. And it will be the victory of the State Department in 1940. In the Nationality Act of 1940, the provision against the American living abroad and many native-born Americans as to permit their denationalization has been hugely expanded at the request of the State Department.
Okay,
but if you want to tell me an additional thing about Fickersham, he became the lawyer of a Japanese-American who was denaturalized because Asian could not be naturalized. And he also, in a report, he was asked about prohibition of alcohol. He explained by his own decision his mission and dealt with the fact that immigrants didn't have any way of appealing in front of expulsion decision. And he is at the origin of the first, I would say, administrative proceeding that permits today immigrants to get at least some hearings before being deported, etc. So he's a hero, I would say, a known of the cause of foreign-born American and immigrants.
Yes, definitely. And you mention him again in another fascinating chapter in which you talk about another person who I think is one of your heroes in the book, Wendell Willkie, in the context of the Schneiderman decision. And I thought that maybe you can talk a little bit about Willkie and in the context of Wickersham, in terms of the question if they actually represent the same kind of
Republican. Yes, it's a Republican tradition that seems to have been lost today because it's a very liberal tradition. And Wendell Willkie, who was a candidate, the Republican nominee for the election of 1940 and got 45% of the vote of the American people against Franklin Roosevelt. 1 year later, he get a letter from a lawyer, Carol King. Carol King was one of the first women with a law degree from NYU in 1920 and started to dedicate her life of lawyer in defense of foreign-born immigrants, citizens, black union leaders. And to make the story short, she met William Schneiderman, who was the secretary of the Communist Party of the state of California, when she took the defense of Harry Bridge, who was a union leader who has been sent, whose case has been to the Supreme Court 4 times because they tried to denaturalize him, to expel him many, many, many times. And she lost in appeal court, and then she decided to appeal to the Supreme Court. Why did she lose first in the district?
So Schneiderman's
Schneiderman was denaturalized.
Yeah, denaturalized.
Mm-hmm. He was naturalized in the 20s. At the end of the 20s, beginning of the 30s. And he was a communist at that time. And then they denaturalized him for having lied in his pledge of allegiance to the United States. So that was a jurisprudence that has not been checked by the Supreme Court at that time, but was backed by federal court since the First World War, that would say that because it was based on a sociological, I would say, reasoning, I quote, they assume that integration and assimilation progress with the years. So when an immigrant pledges allegiance to the United States at the moment of his or her naturalization, this allegiance should rise through the years. So if 10 years or 20 years after your naturalization you stand against the United States, it means in the mind of the court that had a kind of mental reservation at the moment of your pledge of allegiance, and on that basis they would denaturalize the radicals who stand against the government a long time after his or her naturalization. And on that basis, they denaturalized Schneiderman. So Carol King decided to go to the Supreme Court, but she thought she would lose if she would not call for another lawyer to take the case, because she found herself not very good in court, and she thought also that as a woman she has no chance at all to win in front of the court of that time. So she wrote to Wendell Willkie, because he has expressed in one interview his belief in the First Amendment and in the freedom of thought and for all Americans, and she says, in the name of this value, would you accept to take the case? Check with a friend about who is this Schneiderman? Is it a good man? And he discovered that he was a good man, he never broke the law, he was just a communist who has the right to be a communist in the mind of Willkie, and he decided to take the case. And they won. And they won. In 43.
So a Republican presidential nominee represented.
And he wanted to be the next Republican nominee in 44. He died of a heart attack during the primary.
Yeah, he died of
so
a heart attack, and
he
you bring
the
beautiful words that Carol King says about him in his funeral.
You want me to read you what Carol King says about him?
Yes,
I would love to do that.
Okay.
So when he died, hear what she said. Carol King was a radical, I mean, she was on the left liberal side of the politics, of course. Willkie dead. It is unbelievable. As he gone out of the sun. His handshake was so warm. His laugh so full of fun. He had been so very much alive and loved living. His death was a great personal loss to me, even though it is hard to write of him. But I found in a few days after the public learned of his death, how personal this loss was not only to me, but to people who had just met him or seen him, or even to those who only knew there was a Willkie, a great democratic American with a love for humanity and for the principle in which he believed. Willkie helped unify the country, Republican and Democrat alike, behind the broad vision which made him see contending international forces as one world. One World was the title of one of the book of Willkie.
So this is a moment of unification between a radical leftist and a Republican around the idea of American citizenship, I take it.
Yes, and freedom of speech.
And freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech and respect of the Constitution and of the and it was an incredible battle in the courts, because it was a 5-3 decision. The Chief Justice stood in the minority. He wrote the dissent opinion. Frankfurter was angry after all his colleagues because of this majority reversing a denaturalization, and they try to define, I mean, Chief Justice Stone tried in his opinion to define what was the principle of the Constitution to which Schneiderman was not faithful, but there was no way. The majority said, first of all, after his naturalization, he has freedom of speech like any American, so they reversed all the jurisprudence on Montana Reservation. And at the moment of his naturalization, there was nothing in the statute that forbid a communist to be naturalized. It came after the Second World War.
Yeah.
But I would like here to quote the spirit in which Frankfurter, Felix Frankfurter, was sitting in the minority of the court on that case. was. Because while Alan Stone, the Chief Justice, was writing his dissent opinion, he advised him to include this paragraph. Surely the Congress has the right to exact from aliens to whom the privilege of citizenship are granted attachment to the principle of the Constitution of the United States as much as the USSR has the right to exact and has exacted devotion to its principle from Russian citizens. Chief Justice Stone didn't put this paragraph in his final draft, which was the final opinion which was published at the moment of the pronouncement of the decision.
And the rest of the book indeed is a kind of battle or war, as you put it, between the different judges of the Supreme Court. And if you can say first, in a kind of general way, who are the judges at this time and what are the positions that they represent in this war, in the decisions that you go back to in your book?
So you mean the decision concerning, because until now we have spoken about naturalized citizens.
Right.
And this book has a methodology, which is a micro-legal history book. It takes one provision of the citizenship law of the United States and it studies it from its creation and its insertion of the American law, 1906, until the Supreme Court reduced the scope, reduced hugely the scope of the impact of the provision, and that occurs only in 1964 and 1968, after the court had to deal not with racism, but with cases of natural born American. I just mentioned that the Act of 1940 has expanded hugely the number of cases and number of situations where American born citizens would be deprived of their citizenship for example, voting in foreign election, escaping the draft, joining a foreign army, or even going to live in the country of citizenship of their naturalized parents. That was cases where American-born would be deprived of their citizenship. And so what is interesting is that these cases, this the implementation of this provision start in 1945. And at that time, so it's after the Second World War, it's after everybody assess the impact of the Nazi policy in all fields, the U.S. implement denationalization of their own citizen, 5,000 per year.
So how did that happen? Why did that happen?
And they applied the law.
Why did that law appear at this time?
It was passed in 1940. It could not be applied during the war. With a lot of difficulties because it was targeting American abroad. People voting in foreign election, normally they vote at that time, they vote when they are abroad. At that time. People escaping the draft, they are abroad. So it was absolutely almost impossible. So they suspend the implementation of the law during the war. And they resume it when the war finished. And so, by thousands, American-born are deprived of a citizenship. And here I would say that when the first case arrived in the court and get certiorari, Chief Justice Warren, and you can find that testimony in the papers of Justice Douglas, who would take note of every debate in the conference of the justices, every position, says it's unconstitutional, together with Justice Black. But for the first case, 1955, they just agree unanimously to reverse the denationalization on the basis that the scrutiny that is imposed for denaturalization case in Schneiderman has not been respected in that case. But 3 years later, three cases arrived together in the courts. There is one case of a Japanese-American who found himself in Japan in 1942-43, joined the Japanese army and is deprived for that reason from his citizenship. There is a second case, Trop. Trop is in Casablanca, French Morocco. He's an American army compound. He's depressed. He leaves the compound for 24 hours. He's on his way back. He's arrested by his comrades. And he's sent to the military court and condemned for treason or desertion, sorry, for desertion, and loses his citizenship despite he's only American, and so he's made stateless. And the third case is a case of a guy called Perez, and Perez is a Mexican-American born in El Paso, Texas. He's, as a kid, is moving to Mexico with his parents, and in the age of 20, he is back to the U.S., declaring himself as a citizen, and has to admit he has voted in the election of Mexico, and he has joined the Mexican army, and for that reason, he's also deprived of his citizenship. And at that moment, in these cases, 57, 58, there is a huge battle between, on one side, Frankfurter, who is leading the majority of the court, who says that there is a power of Congress for issue of foreign affairs or military necessity to denationalize an American. And on the other side of the court, you have Black and Warren and Douglas, who consider that Congress has not the power to denationalize any American, but they don't know when they are looking for a reasoning that would permit the Supreme Court to declare all these constitutional.
And what is the reasoning that they actually arrive at?
So they arrive to a reasoning after different steps. In fact, in the case of Trop, there is the Second Circuit has confirmed the denationalization of Trop, but the chief judge of the circuit has dissented and used for his dissent an article published by the Yale Law Journal by a student. It's a student note who argue that to create a stateless is a cruel and unusual punishment. And for its own reasoning, quote Anna Arendt, who has just published a famous book, The Origin of Totalitarianism, in which she has 10 very famous pages on citizenship and loss of citizenship, and in which she defines, I mean, for many, I am not, Anna Arendt's definition is more complex, but for people have heard that she has defined citizenship as a right to have rights.
And this is something that this student note by Stephen Pollack picks up and somehow...
Yes. And it goes, and the chief judge says, this note is great, and I rely on... And then the clerk of Warren, John Newman, the Yale Law School of this author, of course, have read the note and use it for his work.
So this
on
is
the opinion of Trump.
So this is how Hannah Arendt actually reaches the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court.
And contribute to saving the citizenship status of Mr. Trump. But her reasoning doesn't save the status of Mr. Perez, because Mr. Trump lost any. I mean, if he loses his American citizenship, has no right to have right anywhere. He's stateless. As Mr. Perez, who was a Mexican American. The reasoning of citizenship as a right to have rights could not protect him from denationalization because he was still having right to have rights in Mexico. And so the Hannah Arendt approach of citizenship was interesting. It contributed to have Warren recover a majority in the case of Trump, but it was not a basis of protection of all America. And it is where intervenes a new concept, or a concept that has been revived or resumed, and the concept of the sovereignty of the citizen.
Which is the basic concept of the book, I take it.
From which I've taken the title of the book, because I thought when I discovered, I mean, I discovered an extraordinary document, five pages, handwritten notes from Chief Justice Warren about these cases. And he says, in this, with 17 different points, he says, whether the concept was of compact federalism, sovereignty of the individual, or some other, citizenship is the basic and inalienable right of the individual.
Yeah. And you actually met with Stephen Pollack, the author of the student note. How was that? How did he feel to be contacted about a student note so many years later?
So, first of all, he has already been interviewed, and it is known that he's at the origin of this note, together with the editor of the Yale Law Journal of that time, Norbert Schley, who would be the clerk of Justice Harlan the year of the decision. So Schley plays a role too in having this note get an impact. I think, of course, he's very proud of that. And he recognized also the role of his professor, Marius MacDougall, who has initiated, I mean, I think the paper, the article, he has said right on that.
Marius MacDougall.
Yes, exactly.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what is more, more important, it is that the idea. I mean, it's Warren's notes, but it seems that these Warren's notes were taken during a conversation with one of the Supreme Court justices, and the one with whom he had conversation on these cases was Justice Black, and so the idea of the sovereignty of the citizen probably come from Black.
Okay, and the last case in the book is a case called Afroyim, which we actually didn't talk about yet, and I'm wondering if we can just somehow conclude the narrative that the book presents through a short kind of...
Afroyim was a case of an Israeli-American who has voted, like Perez, who has voted in the Mexican election. Afroyim has voted in the Israeli Knesset election. And so he was deprived of his citizenship following the jurisprudence of Perez. And it is at that moment that position of Bremen, who, as always, was voted against Black, Douglas, and Warren in Perez, and has immediately or almost immediately regretted it and wrote and written that he has regretted it. Now they had Brennan with them. And they had and they get the majority of one vote to reverse Perez and to affirm the absolute protection of the American citizen under an interpretation, a literal interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And let me, so the what is very moving, it is that the case is given by Chief Justice Warren to Black, who probably, as I just told you, was at the origin of the concept of the sovereignty of the citizen. And he delivered this strong opinion. And let me, so what is interesting is that Black, first of all, he reads the 14th Amendment the way I will now quote. Section 1st of the 14th Amendment that confers citizenship and narrow a person born here with citizenship also provide that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privilege or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The first of these two clauses plainly makes privileges and immunities of United States citizenship free from abridgment by a state. The amendment then goes on to recognize a power in state to deprive all persons, including citizens, of life, liberty, or property if they are afforded due process of law. But even if afforded due process of law, the state is granted no power under the 14th Amendment to deprive any person of the citizenship granted by the 14th Amendment.
And that what the sovereignty of the citizen means, I take it. That is the...
Well, that is not exactly, because you could say that's a reading of the 14th Amendment which is provide an absolute right. But what is stronger than that? It is that Black relied the 14th Amendment. He says the 14th Amendment crystallized something which is at the origin of the country. This country, United States, was created, the state, in this country, the state was created by its citizens. So a group of people, which are the government, cannot deprive them of their citizenship because they are the delegates in some way of the citizen, who are the origin of the power they get. So, for him, it's not only a literal reading of the 14th Amendment that provides this absolute right, a protective right. It's the fact that it's the 14th Amendment illustrate or crystallize or implement something that is implicit in the origin of the United States.
Fascinating. Great, wonderful. I think that is really very, very interesting. And it's kind of a theory of social contract that is very fundamental and has very deep implications potentially. I'm wondering, what are you doing with this now? How have you kind of continued the work since the publication of the book? And what are the other issues that the idea of the sovereign citizen can address in your scholarship?
So thanks a lot for this question. I mean, I am now working. First of all, I will do the second volume of the comparison. That's something.
What is the second volume?
Which will compare. What was my original project, comparing the UK, the US, the French, toward the Nazi, etc. Comparing, and you know there is an issue, I mean the denationalization, denaturalization has been revived after September 11 in many countries. And so you have, what do you do with that? So that's still something I'm working on.
Is that something that you feel that can happen in this country with a reversal of the jurisprudence in the Supreme Court?
I don't think so. I think when you look at the jurisprudence that has come after Afroim, and even in the 90s, you find a convergence between the liberal side of the court and some conservative members of the court who found themselves very eager to defend the citizen against intrusion of the state. And so I must say that in this field of this absolute protection of citizenship, I think the court is quite unanimous or very strongly majority in the defense of the jurisprudence. I am working on trying to understand why the concept of sovereign citizenship has not received the attention that I think it should have received and still should receive in theory. Because if you look at the reception of Afroim and of the dissent of Chief Justice Warren in Perez, either it was not noticed that they have used the concept of sovereignty of the citizen, either it was contempted by the only one scholar that has noticed it, Alexander Bicon. And so I am now writing about, can a citizen be sovereign? And my answer, as you can presume, is yes.
Okay.
And I would show it.
I will be looking forward to those pieces. And I think we took enough of your time right now for this evening. I really want to thank you again for...
I want to thank you. You too, again.
Okay, great. It was wonderful having you. Thank you so much.